How do you like your economic news? Big picture or fine grain? Both do have their advantages. We are going big today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the 16th of September today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We, as I said, are going to start big picture on this Wednesday, a little bit of macro in your economic digest. We're going to do it with a couple of numbers, and we're going to do it with a bunch of words. The numbers came to us from the Commerce Department this morning in the form of the monthly report on retail sales, up 0.6% July to August, a touch slower than a month ago. Another marker that this recovery, as much as we can call it that, is itself slowing down. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour gets us going.
If you don't have more money, you're probably not going to spend more money.
I think this all reflects the fact that at the end of July, the supplemental unemployment benefits ended, the extra $600 that people were getting.
Tendai Kapfidze is chief economist at LendingTree. Less pandemic relief money in unemployed people's pockets slowed down spending growth. Still, from afar, the retail segment as a whole has made a pretty strong recovery. James Boniker is associate director with IHS Market.
Sales as of August are higher than they were heading into the pandemic in February.
But if you look into the details, it is chaos and carnage. Sure, online sales are up 22% year over year, but restaurant sales are still down 15%. Building materials up 15%, clothing down 20%. One thing that is going on here is Americans trapped at home have moved some of their spending around. Constance Hunter is chief economist at KPMG.
There is a switch from services consumption, which makes up the bulk of our consumption, to goods consumption.
Not going to the dentist, but might buy a bike.
It's one of the reasons we've seen manufacturing rebound more than we would have normally expected in a normal recession.
But as time goes on, we are going to start going back to the dentist, and we won't need another bike.
It's one of the reasons we think we'll see a bit of a plateau in retail sales as we go into the fourth quarter. As the economy continues to open and we see people begin to purchase those services again,
people will buy services at the expense of goods. One sign we are headed there is actually buried in the restaurant data. Restaurant sales growth accelerated in August. Maybe a sign that people are getting more and more comfortable going out, at least for now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Good luck buying a bike, by the way. Believe me when I tell you, they are back ordered. All right, anyway, those were the macroeconomic numbers from Sabri. The macroeconomic words come to us today from one Jerome Powell, J to his friends, chair of the Federal Reserve, to you and me. The Fed wrapped up one of its regularly scheduled two-day meetings today. No change in interest rates, which we knew they're going to be low for a very long while, Powell said. Some talk of inflation. The Fed is willing to let it run a bit higher than it used to be willing to do. We have talked to you about that. And then, as often happens when Mr. Powell takes questions, talk turned to fiscal stimulus, Congress and the president, and an economic relief package.
So far, the economy has proven resilient to the lapsing of the CARES Act unemployment, enhanced unemployment benefits.
Yes, totally true.
But there's certainly a risk, though, that those who are unemployed appear to have saved some of those benefits, and they'll now spend them.
And
that as the months pass, if there's no follow-up on that, if there isn't additional support and there isn't a job for some of those people who are from industries where it's going to be very hard to find new work, then that will start to show up in economic activity.
So?
Broadly speaking, if we don't get that, then there would certainly be downside risks through the channel I mentioned.
Downside risk is not a phrase you really want to hear the Fed chair bandying about. Peeps, there is no movement, just to be clear, on more relief coming out of Congress. Wall Street, they didn't really care. Today, low rates, high stocks, lather, rinse, repeat. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. Perhaps a little known fact here, the Census Bureau, in addition to counting all of us every 10 years, of which this is one of those counts, make sure you get counted, by the way. Anyway, in addition to doing that, the census does all kinds of other measurements of this country and this economy, including, out this week, a snapshot of health insurance coverage. In 2019, the census says, 9.2% of people did not have health insurance. That's up a bit from 2018, and now, in the middle of a pandemic as we are, all the more newsworthy. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains.
Health insurance in the U.S. is a patchwork of programs. Private insurance, Obamacare exchanges, Medicare, Medicaid, but all together,
nearly 30 million Americans went without coverage at some point in 2019, and that was an increase of about a million people from the previous year.
Jen Mishori is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation.
And those numbers are looking before the pandemic.
Since then, while Mishori says the estimates vary widely, an additional 5 to 10 million people may have lost health insurance. That's because most of the people who did have health insurance last year got it through their employer. Katherine Baker is dean at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy.
We're seeing some of the consequences of having your health insurance tied to your job in 2019, as well as, of course, in 2020, we're expecting to see big declines in employer-sponsored insurance.
Because a lot of people are losing jobs, and what happens after that depends on where they are, along with things like age and income. Sharon Stern is an assistant division chief at the Census Bureau.
There's a variety of factors, but without a doubt, both private and public coverage rules vary by state.
Some states changed rules around Medicaid access in light of the pandemic or gave people an extra chance to sign up if they found themselves suddenly eligible for the program. Here's Katherine Baker at the University of Chicago again.
So all of the state choices about expansion or not to expand, about how hard to work to enroll people, about how streamlined to make the application process, all of that matters a lot for coverage.
And she says it's going to matter a lot more this year because, you know, pandemic. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We heard Sabree talking earlier about the latest numbers on retail sales. Restaurants and bars, he said, saw the biggest spending increase, nearly 5% July to August. So let us take a second here to tell the story of one particular restaurant for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Tess Thomas. I am the owner of Emma's Barbecue, named after my mother, and I reside in Seattle, Washington. My mom did not read or write. My dad had a fifth grade education, hopped trains to bring the family from the South to here. And Emma just was a person that anything she could smell or taste, she could put her twist to it, and it became something delectable. Her recipes go back to the days of slavery. I've tweaked them just a little bit, but I have a love of these recipes. Emma was one that if you went and asked her, well, how do I make this, Mom? She'd say, well, a little pinch of this and a little pinch of that. And that was her way of telling you, if you really want to know something, you will come and watch me and be with me. Well, my niece saw a place that was just blocks from my home, and she said, you know, you kind of been wanting to open a restaurant. Why don't you open a restaurant? Towards the end, we were, you know, everybody kind of kept the faith because they wanted, you know, they wanted this to happen, and money was getting slim. I had a friend that came through with a $10,000 gift. He just came in one day and saw me kind of in despair of wow, how am I going to make this next hurdle? Now I have to have this piece of equipment that I don't know where I'm going to get it, but if I don't get it, it can't open. And he saw me in that despair and lent. I wanted it to be alone, and he said, if you want it to be alone, you need to go somewhere else. This is a gift to you because I see how hard you're trying to make a difference and have something in this community that represents you as a people. And I get emotional thinking of what he did because it made all the difference. Having something in the community that young people can look at, African Americans specifically, and people of color can look at and say, they're doing that. I have a chance to do that too. To that end, I just want it to continue. You know, I try to get my granddaughters, and all of the family has been involved in one way or another. If I need help, they come to help, and it's been a family affair.
Tess Thomas, she owns Emma's Barbecue up in Seattle, named, as she said, after her mom. Tell us what's going on in your economy, would you? There is a place you can do that over at marketplace.org. Coming up.
In bathrooms, when there are signs telling us not to graffiti, there are certain people who see those signs, and it's a challenge.
I mean, human behavior. Am I right? But first, I am right, by the way. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 36 points today, about a 10th percent, 28,032. The NASDAQ, thank you, tech stocks, down 139, 1.25%, 11,050. The S&P 500 dropped 15 points, about 0.4%, 33.85. Kimberly was talking a bit about health insurance, so let's take a look at health insurance costs, shall we? The Kaiser Family Foundation says last year the average premium for family coverage was about $20,500 a year. Workers covered by employers contributed on average more than $6,000 a year for those plans, about 30% of the cost. From 2009 to 2019, Kaiser says the average cost of family premiums increased 54%, workers' contributions up 71%. By comparison, Kaiser figures wages rose about 26% across the board. During that time, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. For the movie buffs among you, those who enjoy the communal experience of the big screen in a darkened theater, well, our condolences, because it's looking like it's going to be a bare-bones kind of fall movie season. Studios already having some box office blues, and given Tenet's disappointing take so far, are pushing back their big titles, some of them until 2021. And if you, the moviegoer, aren't happy, there are some tensions among movie makers, too. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
As I understand it, we're trying to prevent World War III.
Well, okay, it's not that bad, but it's not great either. That's a scene from Tenet, which opened earlier this month, a kind of calculated risk that many say didn't pay off. So far, Tenet has only made about $30 million domestically, and that's spooking studios.
So their reaction now is to postpone any expected blockbusters to a later release date.
That's Professor Arun Sharma from the University of Miami. He says Hollywood got the message loud and clear, which is why Warner Brothers has postponed Wonder Woman 1984.
You've always had everything, while people like me have had nothing.
And for sure, the studio wants to get something for the $200 million it invested in the sequel, so fans of the lassoed superheroine are going to have to wait till Christmas to see her on the big screen. Now it's rumored Black Widow and James Bond No Time to Die, both due in November, will get postponed too. A fall season with no tentpole Hollywood films is bad news for theaters. Professor Jason Squire at USC says some might find it impossible to weather the storm.
If it continues through the holiday season, that's a 9-month storm. And this is really, really a serious event in the history of exhibition.
That's exacerbating tensions in Hollywood, which for decades has built audiences around shiny content. Lassos, car chases, spies, intergalactic battles. For now, studios seem to be leaning towards playing it safe and putting the lasso away until winter. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
A theme, if you will, of a lot of our work the past 6 months has been adaptation. How businesses are adapting not only to this pandemic, but also the pandemic-specific needs of their customers. Public libraries have been adapting since long before this coronavirus hit, and they are doing it now, too. Jennifer Pearson is the director of the Marshall County Memorial Library in Tennessee, also the president of the Association for Rural and Small Libraries. We talked to her back in May when library doors were still closed. They are open now, so we got her back on the phone. Jennifer, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you again, too, Kai.
So you are, I think, back at regular hours. Doors are open. A big change from the last time we talked. How's it going?
Absolutely, yes. We are, our doors are open. We have people in and out all the time now. It's going pretty well. We are doing appointments just to maintain a number count in here. We don't want the numbers to get too high. We've started to see an uptick in people coming in, and it's going pretty well.
What are folks doing?
Well, the first thing we did was to open our public computers for appointment because a lot of people need those services to fill out job applications or unemployment forms. We still have some people coming in for the traditional things, you know, finding a book and taking it home. School started here August the 3rd with zero mask mandates.
Wow.
You could either go, you could either go virtual or go in person. So another thing that we're doing here is trying to help the kids who need a little help with the virtual schooling, whether that be tech help or they need the Wi-Fi that we have here or they just need homework help. So really the reason we opened up to our regular hours was to help the kids after school so that we'd have plenty of hours after school for them and on Saturdays.
Yeah, I'm going to sound surprised when I say this, but you're going to tell me it's old hat. It seems like a lot of what you're doing at your library, and one assumes many other small and rural libraries across the country, is more along the lines of social services than traditional old line library stuff.
You're absolutely right. And I will tell you it's old hat, but I will tell you that sort of thing has ramped up since COVID has been around in terms of people needing social services and needing our services.
Yeah. Let me ask you a rubber meets the road question. We've done a lot of stories in the marketplace about the budget jam that states and local governments are going to find themselves and are finding themselves in right now. Because of declining tax revenues and all of those things that we know have happened because of this pandemic. Are you getting squeezed budget-wise?
I personally am not getting squeezed. I took my budget to our budget committee, our county commissioners, and I said, I just want a flat budget. I know this is not the time to be asking for things. I know that, you know, tax revenues are going to be off. They're generous when they can be, and I knew they couldn't be this year, so I just didn't ask.
We're
just sailing along like we did last year.
Well, so speaking of sailing along and a year, what do you think? I mean, this is a tough one, right? But what's your library going to be like in a year, do you think?
Well, let's see. I'll put on my futurist hat say what I would like it to be is what it used to be. But that's all going to depend on this virus and getting it under control. I want to see the library lively. I want to see the programs back. I want to see the kids coming in for story time again. But I'm not sure that's what it will be. And it might be that we just continue to streamline our services so that we're doing the most important things for our community.
Jennifer Pearson, she runs the Marshall County Library in Tennessee. She's also the president of the Association for Rural and Small Libraries. Jennifer, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
As of this week, if you step foot on the New York City transit system, subways and buses, you got to wear a mask or risk a $50 fine. Other countries are imposing penalties too, $220 in Singapore, $130 in England. It's happening here in the States as well, a whopping $400 in Glendale here in Southern California. But does fining people actually work? As Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, behavioral economists have some thoughts.
Say I really want you to do something. I can give you $5 for doing it, or take away $5 if you don't. Same incentive, same results, right? Nope. Economist Tatiana Hamanoff studies economics and behavior at New York University.
It might be nice to be rewarded $5, but it's really painful to lose $5. I experience that loss more strongly than I do that gain.
The fancy term for this is loss aversion. And for policymakers trying to nudge people's behavior, it may be better to take away than to give.
We've seen a lot of evidence that incentives that are framed as losses instead of framed as gains, so penalties instead of bonuses or sticks instead of carrots, are more effective.
Hamanoff did a study on plastic shopping bags in the Washington, D.C. area in cities and counties that tried to limit their use for environmental reasons. Some gave 5-cent rewards to shoppers avoiding the bags at checkout, and others taxed people 5 cents for using them. The tax had a huge impact.
Prior to the tax, about 80% of customers used a disposable bag when they shopped. That decreased by about 40 percentage points, so cut in about half.
She found that the small 5-cent tax worked even in the richest neighborhoods, whereas cities that gave bonuses to shoppers who declined plastic bags saw zero change in behavior. Hamanoff takes no position on masks, but clearly some policymakers hope penalties are effective. And there could be another psychological force at work here. Behavioral scientist Gretchen Chapman at Carnegie Mellon says penalties also signal authority to people who think,
oh, hey, the governor is really serious about people wearing a mask. Maybe I sort of want to do what the governor wants me to do, or somehow it raises the specter for me that this is an important public health behavior.
Sounds like a case for Big Brother, assuming fines are actually enforced. But hold on. Behavioral scientists have also found that bans and fines have a cost.
The idea that somebody else or something else is going to control us, we push back.
That's behavioral economist David Just at Cornell talking about a concept called reactance, people asserting their freedom when it's taken away.
In bathrooms, when there are signs telling us not to graffiti, there are certain people who see those signs and it's a challenge.
You know who you are.
You actually find that if you have somewhat threatening signs, you get more graffiti than you would if you didn't have the sign.
And if you tell people to wear masks, some will do the opposite. A poll from the Brookings Institution finds that the number one reason people don't wear them is they feel it's their right not to. So how do you overcome that? David Just suggests a high and punitive tax is more likely to work. But like a lot of things in this pandemic, we're still waiting for the data to come in. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes amid the fires out here, all those tropical storms lined up in the Atlantic and the Gulf. Sally made landfall this morning in Florida. There was the derecho in Iowa a couple of months ago, maybe a month. I don't know. Time flies, right? Anyway, climate change. This item from the Business Roundtable, which maybe isn't getting the coverage it should. The group of 200-some-odd big business CEOs said today it favors putting a price on carbon emissions. Didn't say whether it would like a carbon tax or a cap-and-trade system for carbon pollution permits, but conceivably, it's a big step. All right, we got to go, but here is your midweek moment of economic context, hearkening back to Chair Powell's comments about the real economy and what happens if there is no more relief coming from Washington. This came from the National Multifamily Housing Council, which is the apartment lobby, basically. Its rent tracker shows 86% of apartment households had made a full or partial payment by this past Sunday, which seems okay. But picking up as well on Sabri's story about the recovery slowing down, that number is almost 2.5 percentage points lower than the same month a year ago. The group's president said it's an ongoing deterioration of rent payments, which sounds not good. Our media production team is Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They are going into the studio so the rest of us don't have to, unless your home internet's not reliable, in which case, well, here I am. I'm Kai Ristall. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.